Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmawa. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we're going to be speaking about an interesting topic. Yerusha by Rabistava, by Rabbanis. What happens? You have a world-class, famous Rebbe, Tzaddik, goes to the Olam Elyon, passes away, or Rosh Yeshiva. Now, who do we select as his successor? So, usually it's a family member, a son, very often an older son. And here's the debate. On one hand, we respect the concepts of Yerusha. The family inherits, particularly the oldest son. On the other hand, don't the Talmidim, don't students have rights too? What happens if the father was inspiring, he was a Goyin, he was a Lamdin, or if he's a Rebbe, he's a Tzaddik, his brachas helped, he was charismatic, and the son just isn't. So, don't students, don't chassidim, don't talmidim have rights? So what trumps? The family rights, Yerusha, or the rights of the talmidim? So we're going to have, for this program, we're going to have Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. We'll have Rabbi Zalman Graus, who's a dayan, he's a toyan. He did the satmar when the two brothers disagreed. He was the dayan who sat on it, one of the dayanim, Babov. Tells, so he has vast experience, real hands-on life experience in this topic. We're going to have a historian, Rabbi Pinny Donner from Los Angeles. He's going to be speaking about early Hasidus and in the Litvish world, what happened there, both in Volozhin, the Talmidei HaBaal Shem. We're going to have somebody who actually went through one of these Dinei Torah, Rabbi Zalman Gifter, who was one point Rosh Yeshiva in Tells. Then we're going to have a world-class Harvard management consultant, Me'ovai Techakmeni. We're going to have somebody who advises Fortune 500 companies on succession planning. Among the things that I'm going to ask him are, what would it be like, just imagine, if the only person who could play right field in Yankee Stadium is an Einikel of Babe Ruth? Do you think the Yankees would win? That's one side of the argument. The other side of the argument, and remember, my wife comes from Rosh Yeshiva's house, you know, in corporations. Yeah, even if the family doesn't lead, but they're shareholders, they're financial beneficiaries of the new leader, but the Rosh Yeshiva Shaft, it's for the most part collecting money. It's very, many ways thankless. If they couldn't give anything over to their children, maybe many people would not want to go into chinuch. Should we be considering that? So these and other considerations are what we're going to be speaking about with our esteemed list of guests. Before we go to it, I would like to say a vart on the parsha. And you know, anybody who learns the daf knows that there's chutzpis hameturgamen. Now, isn't it interesting that the mitargim for the Nasi of Shem Gamliel was called Chutzpis HaMetorgim, and Hagavurcha was one of the Asara Harugi Malchus? And, you know, Chazal have a way of making a play on words. And the concept here is that very often the mitargimim, which means somebody who's taking Divrei Elokim Chayim and bringing them into the practical world, there's an element of chutzpah, for lack of a better word to describe it, because how do we know we're giving it over correctly? So I'm going to say a vart now, and if anybody's offended by it, I would like to ask mechila in advance, and maybe if you're a very sensitive soul, maybe please don't listen to it. But here's a vart I want to share with you. The Kotzker Rebbe famously says, it says, this week's parsha, V'anche Kodesh Tiali. And I want to say that, who am I saying this vart for? Do you maybe suffer from, I don't know, depression sometimes? I know I do, right? Anxiety? Do you have maybe, know somebody in your family or a friend who has mood disorders? Or maybe, chas v'shalom, post-traumatic stress, alcohol abuse, opioid abuse? How does the Torah look at all these, you know, health issues, mental health issues? So, there's a word from the Kotzker Rebbe. It says, this week's parasha, V'anshe Kodesh Tiuli. So it seems oxymoronic. Why? Anshe, the word enosh, is used in Chazal, means humankind. When you say somebody has a machla enoishi, it means a machla that can remove him from the human race. Melamed le'enoish bina. Before you have bina, you're called an enoish. Right? So when you say in Hebrew something's enoshi, it means it's human. So it's sort of like human. It's like the lowest level. Kodesh, on the other hand, I mean, when the Ramchal in his Mesil Sisharim, he goes through the 26 Begematria Avaya, Dargis of Avoida, the steps of Avoida, the highest level, the greatest a human could reach is Shar HaKedusha. What do we say? Kav Yochel, Ata Kodesh, V'Shimcha Kodesh, U'Kodeshim, B'chol Yoim Yalucha Sela. The greatest level that a human can aspire to is Kedusha. So to say Anshe Kodesh is putting together two opposites. So the Kutzk Rebbe famously said, you know what the Rabbeinu Sholem wants? He doesn't want Malachim, who sort of flew in from another universe. You know what he wants? He wants humans who are Kodesh. So I want to take that vart and bring it a little further. Who's the first person in the Torah that we see suffered from one of these issues? Noach. What do we know about Noach? It says, Vayochel Noach isha hadama vayita kerem. Noach went ahead, he planted. He's the first time we find wine in the Torah is by Noach, an intoxicating substance. And the Mefarshim say, and the Pirish really says, Vayochel, Smashon Chulin. Why did he plant wine? And let me quote from you, from different Achrayim. You have Reb Moshe David Vali, he was a chaver of Dramchal, a great Mekubal. He says that Noach, right, had to drink wine. He says it was a world that was destroyed. Avad v'nismayit, tnu shecher la'ovid v'yayin la'mori nefesh. Right? Here's a lashon in one of the Achrayim. Havi netayr latzmeinu. Try to imagine Esmar nafshei, the bitterness of the shivrein libay, the broken soul, shel noach l'achra mabel. What did he see? His brothers died, his parents died, his nephews, his nieces. Kashero b'olil shekol olam chariv. So what did he do? He took wine. Wine was the only substance that you could drown pain in. And what does it say afterwards? So we know that he suffered, according to Zechariah, from mar nefesh, depression, right? And he went to wine. He became the first wine user. The first time wine is mentioned in the Torah is to drown out pain. The lashon of these mefarshim is Rav David Moshe Vali, tnu she'loivit v'yayin l'mori nefesh. This is not happy wine of a party. This is yayin l'mori nefesh. So here it's interesting. So how do we deal with depression? Somebody you know is depressed, right? And remember, this is a person who's called Noach Ish Tzadik. So what does the next pasuk say? It tells us two ways. Vayarchom avi kinan es erev asaviv. Vayagid l'shnei echav b'chutz. So Rashi says, brings Chazal, he was Mesaris aviv. He emasculated him, which doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense. So Rav Hirsch says something beautiful. Noach also lived by the Dor HaFlaga, but he didn't have any effect on them. Noach should have been the hero of the world. Noach is the only person ever who saved the entire planet. Right? And not only that, he did it, you know, it's 120 years. He built the Teva. If you look at the Chazal, he was mocked. He was laughed at. He's a ridicule. This absurd maimon. I mean, he was Mekayim Tzadik Bemunasa Yichya. Every day he was in the New York Times. They made litzanis of that religious fanatic Meshugana building a Teva. But he saved the world. Right? And afterwards, he went into PTSD. He had post-traumatic stress disorder, like he says. What's the exact lashon? Netayr latzmeinu es mar nefesh. Right? He had great empathy. If somebody didn't have empathy and feeling, he wouldn't, they died, I lived. So where did his mar nefesh come? From empathy. So Noach should have been held up as a shining example. Look, Tzadik b'emunasa yichyeh. Look at his shivrin lev. It comes from reimimus, from empathy. What does Chum do? He says, what? My papa, He's a drunk. So Rafer says he emasculated him by labeling him, totally mislabeling him as a drunk. He totally took away Noach's entire ability to affect the generation, and that's why the Der HaFlaga comes along. Noach should have been the biggest hero. When somebody's suffering, do you know, if you think of the people, it's usually the most sensitive guy. If you have children, it's your sensitive child, the one who, when a butterfly falls or when a bird breaks its wing, puts it into a box and tries to bring it worms and then cries when the bird dies. That's the one who very often suffers from depression. The pain of the world gets to them. It could be looked at two ways. It could be looked at, ha, he's depressed, she's depressed, or what a sensitive soul. So the Torah says, or, Kenan, you misframed it. The Torah says that sensitivity, the anxiety, these are things that we could look at as a place that come from Roimimus. Where's the next time we see in the Torah? Yaakov Avinu, right? It says, Yaakov, Tzuras Yaakov is chakuka bekisei hakavod. In fact, when we say the bracha of Ata Kadosh, the third bracha refers to Yaakov. What does Yaakov say about himself? Yemei shnei megurai, my life, ma'atim v'ra'im, he tells Pari. I had a bitter life. What does it say? Vayis'abil al b'noi yamim rabim. For 22 years he cried. And Chazal say, why? Ein hashchina shari, those 22 years, mitoich atzvas, from depression. 22 years, ein hashchina shari, mitoich atzvas. And what do we say about Yaakov? What do we say about Noach? Noach is the only person, the one who vayiskal b'soichayel, he rolled in his drunkenness. Noach is the only person who the Torah calls ish tzaddik. And let's continue. I'm going to jump a little, but many more examples. I'm only going to choose four. What do we know about Shaul? Shaul is the only person in the Torah who's called Bechir Hashem, the chosen of God. What does it say about Shaul? Shaul talks about the Ruach Ra, this evil spirit that envelops him. And the Malbim calls it Choli HaMelinkali, right? And Malbim says right over there on the Pasuk, it's Shmuel Aleph to Zion, Yudal to Zvav. He said, Psukim he says he suffered from melancholy, from depression, from marashkara. And the Malbim says, there's only one, two ways to get to it. Either through medicine, which he didn't do, for your wine or alcohol medicine, or through music. He tried music. And what is he still called? He's called Bechir Hashem. Now, the depression of Shaul, I would suggest, is different. We understand Noach, the world is destroyed. Yaakov's missing. He believes he's missing a child. Shaul was the most handsome man in the generation. He's called beautiful. He was the tallest, strapping hero, and he becomes the king. Right? And he comes from Yosef, and he's depressed. Marash Chayra. What is that about? Different type of Marash Chayra. There are people, they're perfectionists. Shaul ba'achas v'olsalai. Any mistake, you know, I did really well, but you know what? Couldn't you have done better? You know, and your feher, you got a 99, I got a 98, a 90. Come on, what happened to me? I learned so many hours. I could so-and-so did even better. You could be the Melech Yisrael and suffer from melancholy. But here's what's interesting. He had this Marash Chayrus melancholy. He's still called Bechir Hashem. What is the Yaris Dvash? Well, Nefesh HaChaim, the great Reb Chaim V'Lozhina. What does he write about David HaMelech? He writes on the Pasuk, Damisi Lekas Midbar. He says the Kas is a bird that screams day and night and it flies away in solitude. So he says it has Marash Chayrus. He says, David has it himself many times in Tillim, right? Ki ofer kalechem achalti. Somebody walked into you and he said, you know, I sit on the earth and I eat ofer. You know, you would say that maybe it's time to see somebody, right? What does the Nefesh HaChaim call about it? He talks about the Marash Chayra, right, of David. And what does David HaMelech David Malka Mashiach, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim. So what do all the above teach us? Rabbeinu Shalom says, you're in a bad mood, you have mood disorders, you need to drink wine, you're PTSD, but you could still be holy. You could be holy like Noach Ish Tzadik, like Yaakov Tzurasi B'Chakuka B'Kisi HaKavod, like Shaul who's the Bechir Hashem, like David Malka Mashiach, Anshe Kodesh Tiuli, I embrace you. You could be holy with all of these human issues because I want humans. I don't want malachim. I want you. I embrace you. I love you with all your human foibles. That is Anshe Kodesh Tiuli. I want to say now the riddle of the week. Okay, here's a real geshmaka riddle. It says, "V'nosnu ish kaifer nafshei." By the way, next week is Parsha Shkalim, so we're going to ask a riddle for Parsha Shkalim. It says in Sechta Shkalim, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Gimel, "Noshim don't give Shkalim," and the Rav says why? Because it says, "Ish kaifer nafshei, ish v'la isha." The Shkalim, remember, is what they used for Karbanos Tzibur. Right? So, Noshim did not contribute to the Karbanos Tzibur. So L'chayr Rabbi Akiva Ega says in Shaul Shuvah Simen Tes that Noshim are potter from Tfilas Musaf. Why? Because since the Tfilas Musaf is neged the Musafim, the carbon Musaf, he says since Noshim did not contribute to the Karbanos Tzibur, loy hayu shaykois, ein lahem chelek b'karbanos Tzibur. Right? So he says both in the Shaul Shuvah and in the Hagoyis on Shulchan Aruch, Archaim Simon Kuvov, and in Shuvah Simon Raish and others, that Nashim are potter from Tfilas Musaf. Frek de Welt, right? Since Tfilas Musaf is Tali, like Rabbi Kivega says, Tafka in somebody who gives the Shkalim, the Karbanos Tzibur, Vachaira, when do males give from what age? Only from Mibet Esrim Shana Ulamaila. Right? So Lechaira, a boy who's less than 20, should also be pata from Tfilas Musaf. Right? Now, even if you're going to say they could be Chayav al Tzchinach, but Lechaira, certainly you should not allow a boy who's less than 20 to go up to the Amid for carbon, for Musaf, because we're Mechuyiv Me'ikar Adin, and they are not. Right, so the question is double. Why is a boy less than 20, according to Rabbi Akiva Eger, chayiv and musaf, it should be just like an isha? And secondly, even if you're going to say yizaltz chinuch, he should certainly not allow to be daven for the amid. And to my knowledge, I don't know of shuls that do not allow 20-year-old, 19-year-old boys to daven musaf. That is our riddle of the week. Before we go to our guests, I want to give you a quick overview of the four opinions of Yerusha Barabbanus, okay? And there are four shittas, and so really almost every opinion, if you're in a Din Torah, you could really say Kimli, okay? First opinion is the Magen Avram in Siman Nun Gimel brings from the Marshdam. He says, Kol haminuyim sheim kese Torah ein b'neim kaidmem. He brings it from the Marami Panu, that there's no din of Yerusha by keser Torah, only by Malchus and Kahuna, and the Chassam Sofer talks about it, and the Chassam Sofer says, we'll put all these online. He says, there's a concept of Shnei Ksuvim Aboim Kechadein Melamdim. Since we have by Kahuna, it says by Kohen Gadol Tachas Aviv, and since by a Melech it says Benai, he says, Dafka these two. But it excludes, obviously, Keset Torah. Right, that is the first Shita, that by Torah there is no Yerusha, only by Malchus and only by Kahuna. So therefore, Rabistav is, in other words, Rebis or Rashivis, no Yerusha whatsoever. That's in the Magen Avraham, Paskins and Shulchan Aruch. First opinion. Second opinion, that Barabbanus, there is Noeg Rabbanus, and that is the Rivash, which is brought in the Magen, in the Ramah, in two different places in Shulchan Aruch, Sayin Yeridei and Reish Mem Hei, Sayin, I believe it's in Nun Gimel also. We'll put all these online. And You're going to hear Rabbi Graus has a very interesting take. He's going to disagree. He's going to say that's not pshat in the Rivash and that's not pshat in the Ramah. But this is the second opinion that Barabonus there is a Yerusha. Opposite opinion. Third opinion. That Yerusha Barabonis is only Lefi Minig Hamakaim, and this is that same Magen Avram brings the Tshuvas HaRajba that says it's totally in the Minig Hamakaim. So it's third opinion. It's not absolute. What is the Minig? And the fourth Shita is that there is a mitzvah Limnei says HaBen, but it's not a, it's only voluntary. This is sort of a lesser known shita. We'll put it up online. Basically, three opinions. There is Yerusha Barabanus, there isn't be Yerusha Barabanus, or is Talu Lefi Minig Amakim. We'll put the Mara Makimus on. Let's go to our guests.
We're honored to have with us Harav Hagoyin, Reb Hershel Shechta, Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and the Kail with us on the line. Welcome to the Rosh Yeshiva.
Good evening, Shalom Aleichem.
A lot of yeshivas today, and not just yeshivas, rabistavas, the oldest son or one of the sons automatically gets to be the Rosh Yeshiva, whatever it is. And clearly, you know, if there's you have yeshivas where there's thousands of people, it would be a remarkable coincidence that the oldest son of Rosh Yeshiva happens to be the biggest Talmud Chacham of all the thousand younger light there, right?
Right.
And the answer is it's not, but they do it because of Yerusha, right? And I guess, you know, the Ramah says, you know, B'noi Chacham K'tzas. So does it create a problem? I mean, imagine imagine if in the Yankees, the only person who could play right field is Babe Ruth Einickel, right?
Yeah.
They would never win a game. So when we give, you know, yeshivas over the Yerusha, it has to be, you know, the yeshiva's son, it said the onus automatically gets the shtela. Aren't we disenfranchising all the Talmidim that they grow up without a real Rosh Yeshiva, without a real Lamda? Like, how do we balance the halachas of Yerusha of Srara with the needs of the Bachram, of the Talmidim?
That's right. I think this is going to be the utter destruction of those yeshivas where they insist on only having family. The outsiders feel, we're outsiders, why should we even donate to the yeshiva? It's a family affair. Why should I enrich that family? And you're cheating the Talmidim, stuck and not right.
But how do we deal with the Ramah? I think it's in Reish Mem Aleph or Reish Mem Beis that says that Wagabi, you know, Yerusha by Torah, it's Ben Achaben, Afilu Benoi Chacham Ktsas is the lashon of the Ramah. Chacham Ktsas. How do we, somebody went to it in Torah in front of you, how would you paskin?
I don't think that in Shulchan Aruch, they're not talking about yeshiva where the Talmidim are 20 years old. Those are the Talmidim are before Bar Mitzvah. So how much do you have to know? You have to know all the Torah to teach younger children. But if you're teaching older boys, you have to know. You have to know a big hekif. And the older son, a lot of times, is not qualified. Stuck and not right.
But we learn it from the dinim of Srara is Xeris HaKasav. It's not Mechalik between older or younger.
But he's not Roy Lekach.
Well, so if he's Roy Lekach B'Yira, the Rambam says, or the Shulchan Aruch says, Rambam actually uses a different nafs. Rambam says B'Yira U'B'Chachma. But Ramaz changes it. If he's Roy B'Yira and Chachma K'tzas, he extends the halach of Srara. In Srara, you don't see a chilek between older and younger.
He's not Roy Lekach. If it's older boys, he's not Roy Lekach. Roy Lekach, you have to have the best one. Otherwise, the Talmidim will go to a different yeshiva. They're not meshubah to go to this yeshiva. The yeshiva will lose out in the end. If you're going to insist on only having family and all from the same family, it's just not going to happen. The yeshiva is going to be the destruction of the yeshiva.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and it's always a great honor to have the Rosh Yeshiva with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Joining us from New York is Rav Zalman Graus. He's the Mechaber of many Sfarim, Rishuyei Se'erevin, Four Chalakim Habari V'Hashema, Birchas Alechem. He was a Magid Shir and a Ram in Belz. He's one of the editors of the Eitzer HaPoskim, and he's arguably the most famous Tayin or Zabloy in America. Welcome, Reb Zalman.
Good morning.
So, Reb Zalman, Yerusha Barabbanis, you've advised, you sat on Zabloz, if you just Google your name, on some of the most famous, disagreements, let us say, about Yerusha and Rabbanis. Could you give our Olam, in your, like, sort of like a summary of the different shittas in this matter?
Yes, I will tell you a short hakdama. Whatever I will say is no consensus in it. Everything is shor b'machlokes. But to give you a little bit synopsis. First, in Bavli Yerushalmi is not mentioned, in no place is mentioned that Rabbonis goes Berusha. Not only Rabbonis, any Srora is not going Berusha. It's not mentioned in any place there. More than that, if you're going historically, we don't even find anything that one Chochem, one Rosh Yeshiva took over, his son took over his position. On contrary, we don't almost find that the son took over. Not only that's not halacha, we only find it by Nisim, but even at Nisim, most poskim say that historically it was not automatically a son took over the father's position. It was not at all. We find very extreme, I think is today is close to Dafayoimis, that people that Rabbonim were Mavir Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, even if it was a Nasi. It was not even a position that you cannot Mavir. And when they were Mavrim, they didn't look for somebody in the Mishpoche, they looked anybody. That is when you read, when you learn Gemara.
Reb Zalman, let me add to what you're saying, that when the Rambam in his Hagdama brings the 40 generations from Kabbalah, from Moshe Rabbeinu to Rav Ashi, the only exception, there's not a single Ben Achaben, there's not a single son-in-law, with the exception of what you said, Reb Shimon, Reb Gamliel Hazakin, and that is because, like the famous leader Rami Panu says, they for one short period they merged Kesa Taira and Kesa Malchus. But with that short exception in time, in all 40, is not a single incident where it was handed one to the other.
You are right, and more than that. The Dimkin Sroro is mentioned very often in Chazal, not only as aloha, even in practice, Shires in practice, about a ger. If a ger may hold this Sroro, that Sroro, but it's not mentioned anything about that one Sroro goes to the son. But, there's a big but. The Teres Kahanim and in the Sifro, is mentioned that all Sororis is not talking about Rabbonis, it's talking about Sororis, secular Sororis, or Melech, I would call him, goes Yibirusha from son to son. Separately, what's mentioned by a Kohanim, that's a different issue, but we're talking about Sororis now, not about Kohuna. Sororis is mentioned, but in the language of the Teres Kahanim, and the Sifro is not necessarily that even the Sroro goes as a Yerusha, it's only a Din Kedime, like we have in Kesef Talves Ami, or an Avela, you have to sell it for a Goy, in Kedime, Ger for a Goy, not a Goy. This is all Dinim from Kedime. That means you have Tzedokah, you have to give first for your Korach. But it's not something what's anchored in Yerusha, in Aloha, in a Tvias moment. But the Rambam doesn't look so. The Rambam paskens that every Sror in the language looks that it as is a din Sror.
Let me say the language of the Rambam that you're quoting. The Rambam says exact lashon kol hasroris, and here it gets really tough. V'chol haminuyin shebi Yisrael Yerusha lebnoi uleben benoi adaylam. And then the Rambam puts on a caveat, ben makam. But he says, kol haminuyim shebi Yisrael, which is a tough lesson.
Yes, exactly. But it is very hard to understand this contrast that we don't find it in Chazal. not in Babli, not in Yerushalmi. It is some remorse what people wants to interpret some remorse in it, but it is not very not clear. It's the most extreme interesting is that in a whole story in the Gemara is about Rav Ashi, when the Bnei Yair want to hire somebody, and a whole story, the Marba Rav Ashi, at the end of the day, he got the position, but in a whole story, how he got it, but not in Toras Yerush.
And let me ask you, Rabbi Graus, let me ask you, like, because I went through the sugya a little in preparation. The Sifra that you're mentioning, the Sifri, is by Melech, right? Who Ubanav, right? It says by the Melech, Hu Ubanav. So he says, Emes Benoi Oyim Etachtav, Eli Ela Bezebel Vabinai Lechol Parnase Yisrael, which doesn't talk about Rabbanas, Parnase. So he says, Hu Ubanav. I have a question. The Minui HaMelech by Klal Yisrael was Kichol Ha'amim. And the Mefarshim say it doesn't come from Roimimus, it comes from Shiflus. It comes from you want to be like the other nations, etc., like it was a B'dievid. Why do we take a case that's a B'dievid, what's the lumdus that is a free, and then say something that was done, maybe even B'chait, we now want to do it everywhere, that it should be Hubanov? Do you have any svara to that?
Okay, you raised a valid point, but this is a machlokes in Tanoim. In the Rambam, Paskins one shita. There are other Rishonim that Paskins, as you said it, and that's the Pashas from the Psikim, that's what they say, that the Posik in Shoftim and in Posik in Tnach, in Shmuel, looks that is a negative to ask for a Melech and for a Minu for a Melech. But the Rambam, Paskins, like the Zamachlekes, Reb Noiroi, I don't remember the other Tanu, what is Zamachlekes in that. And the Rambam Paskins, that is a mitzvah, one of the mitzvahs, that you are mechuyev of Minu HaMelech. And the other Rishonim, no, it's not a mitzvah, it's a negativity. If you don't have any choice because you want to be competitive to the other Amim, you should Melech. But let me only add, even the other Rishonim, is the Netziv in some place say, if I remember correctly, he's saying that even the other Tanoim, the other Shoinim, is also agree that you have to have some authority. Somebody should run the country. It's a question of how to run the country. Or Shoftim, or Nevi'im, or Chachomim. There's many formats, democracy, many forms of how to run a country. But it's no question that you cannot leave a chaos. Like Shoftim, Shoftim, Nitalecho.
We agree with, clearly you need authority, issues Chareyeyu Chayim Beloi, but my question is the form of Yerush, of authority of a melech, according to many Rishayim is a B'dievid, and yet the Sifra uses that, and Sifri uses that as a model for how all our Sfarah should be.
That is my Sfarah, and I mean, you may be Choylik, my Sfarah is the Sifra, and the Tos Kahanim goes only on the Shita that is a mitzvah for Minu HaMelech.
Aha, okay.
Beside it, I said it before that I don't see words in the Sifra. There's only more hakdomi, kedim, kedim. That means if you want to put a melech, you want to mimana a melech, you should try, if it's a possibility, give the position for the son. The son is already learned by his father. He already knows. He has probably in ginune a melech, nemuse a melech, you know, better to handle it. But beside it, like you give tzedoke, you have to give for your mishpoche. In the same way, it's a din kedime. It's written the Chofetz Chaim has a whole issue about that. If you have to, how much you have to lose, if you want to buy, who you have to buy, if all the dinim is in kesef talves, almis, onich, yani ircho koidem, what is the priorities? And how much you have to spend for these priorities? How much you have to waive if it's one place is more expensive than the other place? If you want to buy something, you have to buy from one of your family, but if it's more expensive, how much is expensive? These all kind of issues is only a dinkedim.
But Rabbi Graus, regardless of where it comes from, Lamaisa, the Rambam brings kolos svaros v'aminuyim, and the Ramah, as you obviously will say, paskins like the Rambam lahalacha. In fact,
not
even
exactly. Not exactly so. Not okay. Exactly. The Ramah if you look in the most...
There's a steer in the Rama, actually, yeah.
I wouldn't say it's a steer. Well, why do you call it a steer?
Well, because in the beginning, the Rama in Yaradeya, in Resh Mem He, brings almost word for word, verbatim, the Lashon HaRambam. I mean, he makes a few changes. The Rambam says it has to be Mamala Makam Vaisa B'chachma Yira. He says, V'heim Chachamim Ktsas, right? And then later on, he says, he brings the Lashon of Minig, which is the sheet of the Rajba, that it's not Tali, absolutely, but he brings the Lashon of Dramaz, where he brings the concept of Minig. So he seems to confuse two sheetas, right?
I wouldn't say this so. I would say that the Ramo understood also that's only a Din Kedima. Even the Rambam says Yerusha, but he would say it's only a Din Kedima. And the Minig is that you are not Makpid in this Kedima. That means you are more Makpid qualities. That's what the Ramo's Psak is.
And let's like go the, not like the Rambam, like the Rajbi is saying.
Yes, exactly. But he doesn't... the Rajbi himself mentions also, it's only against a minig. Well, a minig, you make a minig against the Torah? No, don't make a minig against the Torah. It's only a dinkedime. And the minig is, you shouldn't too much put on this minig, too much eggs in this basket, on the minig. Sometimes you don't have to push this minig, because there is positive points to that minig, and there's negative points to that minig.
But Rabbi Krauss, it could be that that's what the Rama means, but the Goyin brings the Makair of the Rama as the Sefri that you quoted, and the Sefri certainly doesn't seem to imply that it's a Minig.
No. And the Sefri says only a Din Kedime. I say that's a
Din Kedime. I'm saying Kedime. You're saying the Sefri also means a Lashon Kedime, and that's it?
Yes, that's it, yes. Not more than that. It's a Din Kedime. What's my Din Kedime? It's mean, like as I told you before, if you want to give tzedakah, you want to buy something, you should buy a Biyur Mishpoch. That's a Din Kedime. The Gemara is in many places, the Din Kedime doesn't mean it's like, you've seen the Gemara himself.
I understand. Kedime means it's subjective. This is the more appropriate thing. But you have to look at other overriding factors. Rabbi Krauss, let me ask you, the Rivash, which he seems to be quoting the Rama, is speaking about a case...
The Rama is quoting, in contrary, the Rama is quoting the Rivash, you mean?
Yes, the Rama is quoting the Rivash, and in the case of the Rivash is speaking about a case where, you know, a Chacham Echad said he was a bigger Chacham, and he wanted to remove the Rosh Yeshiva because he was bigger, and the Rivash says you can't. The Rivash quotes basically this Sifri, so he seems to take it, I mean, the world learns it literally, and you would learn the Rivash also, that it's just a Kedima.
No, it depends. This is two different issues. The Rivash speaks about removing because you have somebody better.
Right.
No, you don't remove somebody because you have something better. That's the Rivash. And the Rivash says, since it's a Din Kedima even by a son, it's probably you won't remove somebody that's the Rivash point. But the Rivash doesn't go there about the sons. I would only also mention what you say, Chachomim Kitzas, it's not, the Persh is not means that he's a little bit a Chachom than he has already a Din Kedima. That's not what means. If you look in the Akim Moshe, it only means, let's say a Rav dies, and his son is 25 years old or 30 years old. He just finished the Kollel. He doesn't have experience so much in Rabbanus. The father didn't give him so much shemesh because he was young. He was whatever reason is. But the potential is here. That's what means Chachom Kutzas. That means he's not finished yet. He's not graduated fully. He's not integrated in the Rabbanus fully. That's, if you look in the Akim Moshe, that's what it means. The Makor is a Rambam. Rambam Zok Melamdi Moshe. Rambam goes in extreme. Rambam Zok Melamdi Moshe. That means he has a potential to learn. Not that you have to wave a little bit, somebody's a Chochem Ketzas, he's able to be a Rav. No, that's not the pshat.
Now, Rabbi Krauss, two comments. One is that... and I'm sure you're aware of all this. I just want to bring up the conversation. The Gina Zvradim brings a story that, in Tzfas, circa, you know, 1500s, when that Rizal was there and Reb Shlomo Kabetz was there, everybody chose the Alshech to be the Rav after an old Rav had died. And Reb Shlomo Kabetz, the Baal Mechaber of Lechadoidi, objected. He said, no, the Alshech, who was 60 years old, could not be the Rav. And he demoted him. And they said, let's wait for the boy till he becomes bar mitzvah, the son of the existing Rav, till he becomes bar mitzvah. They waited for this period, and Lashon is himlichu b'makim aviv, even though he didn't have any comparison at all to the greatness of the Alshech. We call him the Alshech HaKadosh. And he brings, the Ginnas Radim says, and the Makar of this is the Rambam, that by Malchus, by Haniach ben Katan, Meshamalei Hamluchad Sheyigdol, the same thing by Rabbanus. So the Ginnas Radim seems to take the Lashon of the Rambam much more than just like, you know, like by Tzedakah Kedima, but much more literally. Would you agree with that?
I will tell you only, I said in the Akdome, I told you in the beginning and outset.
I agree with that.
There's
another opinion.
Somebody,
yes, okay.
You find
agreed.
Another opinion.
Right, okay.
I'm talking about the main opinion. The
okay.
Shulchan is very against this Dinrish. But there is another point, other side to it. There's a positive sign. And you know, this a German Sprichwort sagt, is no Nachteil on the Vorteil, and doesn't exist a Vorteil without a Nachteil. You know what I mean? That everything has two sides to it, to the coin. There is a positive side to it, specifically in our time, where yeshivas, you have to give incentive for a Rosh Hashiva or somebody that builds a yeshiva or builds whatever he builds, Moisset, that he has a bigger incentive if he knows his son will take over. That's from one hand. From the other hand, you cannot give everything, you take a rough in a shtot, and you cannot, it's very hard to tell that all his kids, you don't know how his kids will be grown up, and probably there's other candidates, more mukhshorim. It is two sides to this coin. And it was many places in history until, let's say, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, it didn't exist such a thing that a son took over. In fact, you give us in history, go to the oldest series, where became Rabbonim, who took over. Even the Hasidus in the beginning, the Reb Chaim says so. Not the Baal Shem, not the Rebbe Melech, not none. Later on, it starts a different kind of culture. It's also...
Why is that, Rabbi Graus? Why is that?
Okay, I'll give you an example, a very interesting example. Contrary to what people think, the Chassam Sofer didn't have kids until the age of 40 or later on. And it was...
So it was his second marriage to the daughter of Rav Kiveh, I guess.
Yes. It was a generation gap. The Ksav Sofer was 24 or 20, something like that, when his father passed away. The Chassam Sofer passed away. He became the Rabbonus. Had he been born when the Chassam Sofer was 25, he would definitely not take the Rabbonus in Prishvog, because he would have been a Rav in some place else. He had already a position in some place else. Why he would take his father's position? If he is established in one place, he wouldn't take another place. Then, there's automatically, he was a young man, he was not established. He, Ksav Sofer himself, passed away. He was a young man. His son was in young. And therefore, he took over. Not, and Yad Hashgacha Hoseboy, that's clear. But it's a different, usually, not always, even the oldest son took over. Most of the time, the oldest son had already a position. And whoever did not have a position, that's number one. Number two is, if somebody is grown up in a Rav's shtub, and he has the knowledge already, and he knows the people in this city, he knows the town, he knows how to handle these people, he knows the minhoge o'ir, it is much easier for the bnei o'ir to settle him as a Rav than even you take a bigger gadol. then he's not familiar. He's not familiar with all the minhagim, all the nuances. Every city has its nuances, its problems. And if he starts to be an ask and he starts to advise people, therefore people getting close to him, and they took him.
Rabbi Grouse, I appreciate that, but let me ask you. We've all seen in all of these minuyim or sraris, whatever, of rabistava yeshivas, where the heir apparent, which is the usually the oldest son, which by the way is also based on a taisefta called kaidim benachla kaidim besrara. That's what the saimachan, I'm sure. And the son just was just not mamali makamav. He couldn't inspire.
Make a remark, if you may say. The Rambam says that all the son, but not because kol koydim lenachle, because this older son is not always koydim lenachle. If he has, for example, if he's not a bechor, he has an elder sister, is not koydim lenachle. He learned that at kihoy abchor, that's a posik in Tnach. Because he was the oldest, that's getting. But his kdimei nachle is not exactly so.
Okay, even though the Lashon HaGemara is Reb Shimon Amuel, Shimon Bini Bechayr, Shimon Bini, I think that was the Lashon. But notwithstanding, let me finish my point, and regardless, I accept your point. So you have a chassidus, or you have a yeshiva, and the oldest son is just, can't inspire. Now, 40 years of chassidim, or talmidim, they're going to grow up in a semi-midbar. So, they will pay the price. So how do you, as somebody who sat on many dinei Torah, and some of the biggest in the world, how do you respond when somebody says, look, you know, the oldest son is a very fine guy, he's here in Shemayim, he's respectable, but don't we want to create a generation of I mean, the street is a fire. I mean, we're attacked. A frum yid is an endangered species in the world, right? With Lutzonis and any possible way. We need a general. I mean, this is a finer person.
No,
is this the general? So how do you respond as a person? I mean, you have children.
I don't have connection. Nobody forced them. The halacha, I'm telling you again, in halacha, it is very vague, this chus from the son to have Yarshan the Rabbonis or whatever it is. There is another issue. You touch it from one side, but there's many angles to this side, because Rabbonis in Hasidus is not the same. And there's three sides to this issue. The Divrei Chaim says, if Rabbonis, what is Beirusha, but clear that Rabistava is not Eirusha. That's from one hand. But from the other hand, there is an issue what's very, not touched too much in the Posk. If somebody create Moisdes, and he has full authority on the Moisdes, that's not Soror. It's Toivis Hanoi. It's Amchleikus says on a moment, in a moment. Soror, in literally, Soror means Kol Ish Yesoror Bebeisoi, is on a person, not on assets. The Melech didn't have assets, was not Soror asset. Even Melech Poiret together, yes, but the Soror was on people. And all the Minuim means on people, not on assets. Here is a different question, what was created mainly after the war. After people came, and what we call Rabbonis is almost none, and at least in our community, is almost none. No community is taking a Rav. In other way around, the Rav makes a community. He builds buildings, he builds yeshivas, he builds tamtoiris. That is how it usually goes. And here you have assets, and you have Sororan assets, what's more stronger than the regular Sororan. Because so, there is an issue
from Tavis. So let me go to this, Rabbi Graf. So let me go into this point. It's a very important point. So today, you know, they say the Chiddush Arim, he brings in Marian Agoila when he became Rebbe, interestingly, and he wasn't the son of the Katzka. He was a Talmud Chavar of the Katzka. But his first Shabbos, he got up and he said in the beginning it starts with with tzaddikim and your shemayim and hisoyrus, and then it becomes about bank and binyanim. So his first Shabbos he got up. Kumta rain the sitra achri says mit bank and binyanim and achap the nekid and a loif davek. Right. So today what's happened is, you're right, yeshivas don't act, they're not intense, where they're like in the midbar, they went vayachnu vayiso, but it's like there's buildings and apartments and there's, you know, and there's yeshiva ketanis and millions and millions of dollars of real estate. So let me ask you a question. All of this real estate are owned by not-profit organizations, right? And the very essence of a non-profit means it's owned by the tzibur, it's owned by the klal, and there was somebody who is the fiduciary, and if you look at the real, you know, the big American not-for-profits, you look at the starting Harvard, Yale, Princeton, nobody owns those buildings, they're owned by the tzibur. That's what a not-for-profit means. You don't own, in New York State, you have to get the attorney general's permission before you put on a mortgage, before you talk, because you're not the owner. And the Rivash, by the way, in the tshuva that we spoke about, discusses one of the reasons why to keep this Rav who they wanted to depose, because he said he was godly. He says, because the Melech appointed him, and Dina de Malchusa Dina. So who owns a not-for-profit? Pick your favorite yeshiva, beautiful building with Rabbanim, Rosh Yeshivas, Rebbes. Do we say the Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva, owns the building? Or we say, look, we're in America. Dina de Malchusa Dina, it's a not-for-profit. It's the money of the tzibur. You didn't earn it. It was collected from people who gave their maisa. Who owns halachically these buildings?
To my mind, is no question that this is not being owed by anybody. It's next to tzibur. There is a but there is authority. The Gemara gives almost unlimited to Rav Ashi, his shul. That means, Rav Ashi, it was a very small place where Rav Ashi lived, but people used to come there, be chavoyde for Rav Ashi, and they used to donate for Rav Ashi, that means not for Rav Ashi, to give it for a shul, but it was has sole authority, Rav Ashi had sole authority. That means we are not talking about ownership, we are talking about authority. It's a little bit different if somebody has his own shul and for some reason he put in all the money. We had in Torah about that somebody even from his pocket put all the money. He was a businessman, but the shul he felt that it's tax free, and he put it in the name of organization. It's a different story, but when you have a big shul, what is hundreds of people daven there in yeshiva that is being collected from the next tzibur, it doesn't, anybody is not an owner, but we're talking about authority.
Rabbi Graus, do you have a proof to that? Do you have a raya to that? To me it's simple, but is there a halachic proof to that or no?
Okay, let's analyze it. Some people don't differentiate between assets and people. They say automatically, if the Rambam gives you a sroreh on the people, you have a sroreh on the people, on the tzibur. Automatically, you have authority on the next tzibur. Whoever adapts the Rambam fully, they say, Mamanashech, if I am a Rav on this shul, or I am the Rosh Hashiva, then what you want? I don't need more than that. Automatically, I have authority, whatever happened. You cannot tell me what to do. That is one way how to approach it. But the other way is approach it, there's a Kiles Yankiv about it, that like if you initiate, as he's more going with a Miyasid, from a Moisid, it's automatically you have more than Toivis HaNoi, more than a Gabet Tzedokah. Automatically you have authority, not ownership. We have to understand, Balabais in Loshon Kodesh is not always means ownership. Like, it's only authority. Balabais is in many, many places, we won't go in that, but even a husband and wife doesn't mean ownership, you don't owe anything. You have some authority. That's called bailim, but we're not language here. We are simply, the issue is authority, not ownership. And let's forget about ownership. At least, no educated person will say that any Rav has a personal ownership in a mosque.
So, Rabbi Graus, let me go back to my question. Let's say you're sitting now, you're the dayan. we have a yeshiva or a rabistava, rabbanus, or a rebbe, because I don't want to take, you know, pick any community. And the old Rosh Yeshiva, Tzaddik, Rav, Rebbe dies. And the Hasidim, Talmidim, etc., they come to you. And they say, look, there's an older son here. The father was Miyasid. He collected money. They built the buildings, etc. The son is just, he's okay. He's okay. Right? He's Chacham Ktsas. He's boring. He knows how to learn. He learns. He's Erlich. He's not going to inspire us. Do we have a right to go out and find the most competent, the most, you know, it's interesting. There's four companies in the world, Mi'ovei Techakmeni, that are worth more than $1 trillion, right? Microsoft, Apple, Google, Amazon, there's probably one or two more, right? Not a single one did go Birusha, Avla Ben, even though they owned it. I mean, imagine if Microsoft, his son-in-law took it over, Bill Gates. So Apple, Steve Jobs, one of his kids. I mean, it would have been felt very good, and they would have lost 50% of their market cap. It's a war out there. The businesses understand it, and they understand, look, if you want to win the war, you need a real general. And so these guys come, and they say, there's a war out there. There's a war against Yiddishkeit. There's a war against Frumkeit. There's a war against Hasidus. There's a war against Yerushamayim. Every one of these, you have evolution, you have Kofrim, Alamini, you have Znus, you have the internet. We want a general. So we would like to not appoint the Rebbe's oldest son or youngest son. We would like not to appoint our Shiva's oldest son. We want to make, just like Mike, we want to go around the whole world, find a guy who's both culturally understands the Nimusim, and somebody could get up, scream, Mamish, fire up the Olam, you're the Dayan, how do you paskin?
Hey, I can quote you with many quotes from Chofetz Chaim and many quotes from Aruch HaShulchan, that is saying that today we need generals, not only a Rav, we have to have a Loichem. And this, a general doesn't go by Yerusha, they have of them Rayas. And if you look in Chuas van Hoges from Moshe Sternberg,
he said, by Kain Mashiach Mohama.
Yes, another brings from Hashilchen, the Hashilchen says it also in the Kitzer. But it's no question, I'm telling you, halachically is very weak. But from the other hand, if you speak this kind of Chakmeni, is not a comparison. I'll tell you why. Because the owner of these big owners of the oldest company, they're getting millions of dollars, the kids, millions of dollars every year. And even if he doesn't have a position, the father who initiated these companies has an incentive for that money, for himself and for the kids. But in a yeshiva, what even their big Rosh Yeshivas, I'm not talking about, usually Rosh Yeshivas are not having a salary, who knows what. And these kids will remain with nothing. Some of them will be aniyim v'evyonim if they don't get a position. And this is not, if you want to make incentives, you have to give them something. But this is more Svoras, but you cannot compare these companies.
No, I agree with you. I think that's a very valid point. And what my Shver, Zecharon Livracha, he had Beis Shraga, and I'll tell you a funny story. Moshe Reichman, I once met him, and we spoke. He said, oh, I know your father-in-law. He said, I was by your father-in-law in the house. He said, because he had kids that went to Beis Shraga, and he was sitting, my father-in-law's house had a dining room table with 8 chairs, each one from a different set. And he was speaking, so he said, I went through the budget, and every year you're short like $30,000, so what do you do? So he said, it's simple, 1 year I don't take a salary, 1 year my shutif doesn't take a salary. Right? Nope. So I think that these are two conflicting issues. The next generation of Talmidim shouldn't suffer, should not have it lose the war, because the old Rosh Hashiva, who could have been the biggest tzaddik, right, has to support his children. So maybe, like, you need a compromise. Say, look, we need a good general, and we have to take care of the kids that are Rosh Hashiva. We have to give them pensions, stipends, payments. But I think it's conflating two different issues, isn't it?
Yeah, usually that's what Rabbonim do. Not Rosh Hashivas, but Rabbonim do make a pshara on that. for that reason exactly what you are saying. In practical life, if you come to the Torah to most stream Rabbonim, they make this kind of pshat. But in Halacha, I'm telling you, in Halacha is, if you go strict in Halacha, there's no Din Yerush. But it became like a minig, and they say, Aldas Kain, he did it, Aldas Kain, people give them. Some Nadvonim who wants, some Nadvonim giving merely, he wants to Mahzik. We had many Din Torahs in this kind. We spoke to many, many Nadvonim. Many Nadvonim, big Nadvonim, said, I don't care. I like this guy so much. He gave away his life for Torah. Let him do with the money what he wants. I gave it to him. I don't care. I understand that he will do good things. He won't go to Las Vegas with that. But I don't care. I rely whatever he will do. And it's an argument in both sides. And if we go in Kaldas Hanoisen, what we find this also many times in Chazal, it's understandable that the kids have a schus in them.
Rabbi Graus, it's always an honor to have you with us.
Thank you.
Wait, Rabbi Zalman, I want to ask you one more question, okay? Rabbi Graus, the first Rosh Yeshivas, even though you mentioned that by the Rebbes, the Baal Shem, and the Magid, and the Rebbe, you know, the Rebbe Melech, etc., their children did not take over. But interestingly, by the Litvish, it wasn't that way. The first yeshiva was Volozhin, first ever, Chaim Volozhin. His son took over. After that, his son-in-law took over. His son-in-law took over. Is there a difference? I mean, does sons-in-law have a Din Yerusha or not?
I don't know what to talk. I'm not so familiar with the history, but Reb Chaim was also an Einikl and he had two Yichasen. I don't know who you mean, but anyway.
I'm not talking Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim Volozhin.
Okay. Let me explain a little. Adam is not a son in no halacha, no, if you go through Shas, Shulchan Aruch, you won't find one single halacha. If you go Avelis, or Dercheretz, or Makovi Ve'imo, it is so far-fetched. And more than that, if you look in Psukim, you'll find that the Psukim himself, saying that Shaul HaMelech was taken away from his Unizaroi, the Melucha. In fact, an Adam took over. But the Chazal, and many Lishonim, in Posik himself, that Shaul HaMelech was Nichras Melech Mizaroi. That means klar that is not a continuation of Malchus Shaul. We find it again by Salio. Salio killed all Zera HaMelucha. That's the Loshna Posik. He killed the Abed. It's called Zera HaMelucha. Zeram Lucha, but he left over the brother and the son-in-law of the Melech. And then Farshim say, because he's not belonging, it's not Zeram Lucha. It's no Hashash that he would ever take over. That is, I'm not talking about Chazal, because in Chazal is not mentioned anything Sorora, but not Rambam. And only in whatever is a din, is dinim in a ben, is not a daughter, not a son-in-law, is not Shaykh in that. Having said that, in many places, specifically in Edim, even Rabbonis, usually elderly people, usually wanted the daughter should live with them. And not the son, because they were closer to the daughter that she cooks in the home, it's not Yisra Yichud, and she cooks and wash for her parents, then the shneer, then the daughter-in-law, automatically used to be that the son-in-law used to live together with the father-in-law. And if the father-in-law was a rov, and the son-in-law lived with him together, automatically he became shimush, he became equipped with the knowledge, he had the knowledge, and he had the connection with the people in the city. Automatically they wanted him. And more than that, when he took an Adam, a son you cannot choose, but an Adam you can choose. And a Rav, a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, was able to take the best, the Shufra, as an Adam. And therefore, automatically, it became the Eidim, not in anchored as Din Yerush, but some things what you do many, many times. It's people think that this is anchored in Allah. I'll tell you another dogma. Adopted children. We have a few adopted children. I won't mention names, each too. But we have a few adopted children took over Rabbonis in Rabistave. And it was in the father gave money also. Usually, people make it so, if you don't have kids, they have adopted children, they give all the assets for the adopted child. And have many, many these kind of stories. And, but it doesn't mean that halachically is an adopted child. If you find halachically, kolam gadol benoi kili yoldoi, but doesn't mean that he's yoyreshem, kolam amlam toire leben chaberoi kili yoldoi. We find Moshe Rabbeinu took over Yeshua, his Talmud.
But I just want to point out, Rabbi Graus, one thing, is that the Rashba says it's hakol v'i minig amakim. If somebody took the position and they said, listen, you're right halachically, but the minig hamakim has become that the son-in-law does have, is very often Yoyrish. How would you respond to that?
Again, in contrary, the Rashba says it in a negative, not in a positive, because the Rashba say that even though it is a din kedime, the son, but if the minig is that you don't give this din kedime for the son,
so it wouldn't be on the positive too. If the minig
no, definitely not.
I have a raya the other way, because the Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim, when it talks about the concept, let's say, of chazonis, etc. Then most of the poskim say that if the minig hamakim is, and Ur Lagabi Rabbeinu, and Ramosha says very clearly, if the minig hamakim is that once you have a Rebbe, you can't get rid of him, you just can't get rid of him, because it's assumed that it's under that das that he was hired. So if the minig hamakim is that the son-in-law takes over, so it's on that das that the existing Rav took his position, right? Clearly the Paiskim Nemon that the Minig HaMakim would say that's the agreement.
I don't agree. You're talking about two issues that you cannot touch them. You cannot put them together. If I hire somebody, the question of how long do I hire him? For example, Rabbi Moshe says that if you rent a control apartment, you lend them according to the Minig HaMedina. That means you not lease him on a year or 2 years. You lease him for a lifetime on the condition that he pays subject to the government's rules. And the same thing is even Eidah Haredes and Eretz Yisrael. They adopted the secular law in rent control. Because when you rent him not on a limited time. The same thing if you rent somebody, you give him a position, you give him a lifetime position. Only if you make a tenai lehefech. But as long as you don't make a tenai lehefech, we assume that we make him like the same, the color. We don't have to, if I hire somebody for a month, how many hours he has to work a day? 8 hours. Even according to the halacha, he may work from Alasa Shachar at Tzetzakachovim. But the minig is, I hire him al das minig. That is to him. But to go over to his son, that's need. We need kinyonim. I didn't hire the son. I didn't make kinyonim with the son. That is a step further. And maybe you are right. I won't go in it. But you have to know that's a step further, and maybe it doesn't help minhogim here. You have to make actual kinyonim with the son, not a zikui, or what kind of lomdus you will say that.
Rabbi Graus, it's always an honor to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much.
We have on the phone with us Rav Zalman Gifter. He's a Rav in Toms River. He was Rashiva in Tells for a while, and he had a famous entire about it, so he has experience, very relevant to what we're discussing. Welcome, Rav Zalman.
Shalom Aleichem.
So Rav Zalman, tell us, is there a din of Yerusha by Rosh Hashivas, Rabbanis? What's the halacha? If somebody says, look, My father was Rosh Yeshiva. I want to be Rosh Yeshiva. What do you say? Look, you know, Srara, it's a tzibur position. Anybody you want, you know, let the tzibur pick who they believe is most qualified. Tell us about your opinion on this matter.
Okay, so the source of this din, that there is, because there is a din Yerusha, the Rama brings it, but we'll get to that. The source of it is the Sifri in Pasha Shaiftim, where the Pasuk is talking about Melech. The Pasuk says, Man Yarich Yomim Amalachtoi Hu Ubonov Bekerav Yisrael. The Sifri says over there, Shim hu mes benoi oimed tachtov. Says the Sifri, ve'ein li elazeh, maybe it's a special din only by Melech, bilvad, only Melech, minai l'chol panosa Yisrael. How do we know it's in regard to everybody that has a shtela, which is Negei Rabbonis or Rosh Yeshiva, shebeneihem, their children, eindim tachtehem, take their place. Talmud Leimar, the Pasuk Firzais, who ubonav bekerav Yisrael. Says the Sifri, what does it mean, bekerav Yisrael? Kol Shehem bekerav Yisrael, any position which is bekerav Yisrael, which is pertains to a tzibur of Klal Yisrael, b'nai oimed tachtov. His son takes his place when he is nifter. The Rama in Yerideya, in Simon Reish Mem Hei, Sif Chav Beis, says this halacha, passing it la halacha. Now we have to understand, the halacha is that a son yashins Rabbonis and Rosh Yeshiva, as we see in every yeshiva down in the history of Klal Yisrael, right? Now, of course, if B'nai is Ein Aro'i, then there will not be a Din Yerusha. But B'nai Ein Aro'i is not for just any individual or any Talmud Chacham even to paskin that he's Ein Aro'i because he doesn't like what he's doing. Ein Aro'i means he's not acting like someone in that position should be acting. Let's say Rahman al-San, he's a ganev, he's a maneuver, right? So he's ain't a roi, just because he can say shtetaira or say a nice drosha doesn't mean he can take his place. But kol shuhu mamala mekaimai be your osai, even if it's not the chokhmosai, be your osai, which does not mean be your osai, he's at that level of your shamayim, because that is self-understood. But he goes, but there chavayim of your shamayim, the halacha is, he's yairish, the shtela of his father.
Okay, so I have a question for you before, just a halachic question. So
yeah.
if we learn the Rama literally, and the Rama is different than the Lashon HaRambam. The Lashon HaRambam is Hu Shi Haben Mamala Makam Avaisav B'Chachmu B'Yira, and he changes it. The Rama, he says B'Yira V'Heim Chachamim K'tzas. Right. I mean,
right.
Let's face it. There's never going to be a Rosh Hashiva, a Rebbe, a Rava, who you're going to be able to say, he's not Chachamim Ktas. I mean, that's really a very, very minimal level. I mean, the guy's going to say, I could do a Rubik Cube. So
right.
How would you ever, is it, in other words, how would you ever, would you, you know, you have a yeshiva, it's a successful yeshiva, or a Rabistava out of thousands, and, you know, the son comes along, and he knows Ktas. I mean, should this child be you know, leading the next generation?
So there's a Ramah in the other day, Reish Mem Hei, right?
Yeah, we know
Sif Chav Beis.
Yeah.
Right? The Ramah says as follows. Mi shehuvzak l'rav b'ir, afilu hichzik b'atzmai eza shrora. He took the position by himself. That means he established his own shul. Ein lahiride midulosoi, afal pi shebo l'sham acher godol mimenu.
Right.
Then he adds, afilu b'nai u'ben b'nai la'olam kaidmin la'achayim kol zman shemamalim makam avisein b'yira v'hem hachomim tzas. So here he says it clear.
Right. This is your question. Now let's go back to that. You have a guy, right? He's the son of a rebbe, and he learned in yeshiva. He knows. You could talk to him. He's an intelligent fellow. He used to drive the bus. The rebbe dies. There's 100,000 chassidim, and he says, "Look, you can't say I'm not a chacham ktas. I mean, I learned Mishneh Berurah. I asked me a question on Hilchos Shabbos, and they're saying, wait, this guy's going to lead us. He says I'm a chacham ktas. I mean, according to this,
We will not be pirate b'shem, but you know who I'm talking about. There's a very big Rosh Yeshiva that was Nifter, and there was a machloikis about his child, right? Because the child did drive a bus, right?
Okay, I just picked an example, yeah? Okay.
And he became the Rosh Yeshiva.
So I'm asking you, is that good? Do the Talmidim have any rights? Does the next generation have any rights? I mean, do your children have any rights? Or you say, listen, he could be the most incompetent person. He's chacham ktsas. It's a very low barrier. Should we like?
Okay, so I would not learn chacham ktsas. That's such a low barrier, right?
Well,
he's a man that can get up and say. Chacham Tzatz means that he can get up and say a shir,
okay,
but he can't say a shir at that level.
Close to that level. Chacham Tzatz. Right? So basically we would end up, I mean, so here you have kids, they're faced with, let's face it, growing up today, there's the internet, there's mental health issues, there's pornography issues, there's gambling issues, there's drinking issues. You want your kid to go to yeshiva to really get inspired. And you send him to a yeshiva, or a rebbe. The rebbe mamish used to do moifsim. His he dies. The kid becomes, and he says, "Look, I'm a chacham ktsas." So is that the end of your kid? I mean, he's going to be on the internet an hour later. Like, if you take this ramah literally, is that dangerous at all?
So that is the other part of the ramah, that if he's not has no shaychus to the yira part.
He's a Yira.
Right.
He's a real Yira Shemayim. This guy goes to the mikveh every day. He's
but he doesn't have Yira Shemayim if he's doing the other things, right? So that's the chisar of Yira Shemayim.
No, he's a Yira Shemayim. He's a Chacham Ktsas. He's a fine Kail guy in whatever Chassidish Shemayim they are. The Rebbe dies. Now you need a general to lead them to war against the Friar, the street, etc. I mean, And by the way, G'dayli Achrayim, the Divrei Malkiel, etc., they address this Ramah, and they say the Ramah is really taken at, it's not what he means. They say Chacham Ktsas means he hasn't yet risen to the stature of his father, but he's going to become his father. He's going to become.
But that's
like,
you understand
like
yourself.
So, but otherwise, we're basically saying, you know, every other Hesiris, Beraisi, Kol Ir, every Hesiris, Altila Benuya, in business, they're picking the best business people. In media, they're picking the best media people. Social, it's the survival of the fittest. Entertainment, the best actor, the best looking actress. When it comes to Torah, it's okay. If he's okay, he's good. This is the general who's going to lead us. Does that seem like a good decision?
Well, let me ask you, let's be realistic. It's easier for me to say it Klap Rosh Yeshiva because that's where I grew up, not in the Rebbe's field, right? We have seen in history, even before World War II, there were different levels of Rosh Yeshivas. Now, we know that in Radin, the Eirik HaChofetz Chaim, right, there was a big machlokes there, whether Reb Naftali should become Rosh Yeshiva. And the Olam wanted Reb Naftali, because Reb Naftali was a lot bigger than Reb Mendel's ex. And the Chofetz Chaim said, it's my yeshiva, and I decide who's Rosh Yeshiva, and that's it. And my Adam, Reb Mendel, is becoming Rosh Yeshiva. These
so
are
I'm
facts.
Asking you, look, but I'm not looking back, Would you, if you you are Klal Yisrael, are you better off with Reb Naftali Trapp or with Reb Mendel Zaks as Rosh Yeshiva?
I'll answer it that Reb Naftali had a shtela afterwards, and there was no problem of him taking Bochum that went with him. But who's going to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Radin? Rosh Yeshiva in Radin is going to be who the Chofetz Chaim says. In Telz, there was Hopkis when the Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch, the Baal Shuri Das, brought in his son, the Rabbi Lemeir Bloch, to say his shir. And the Bochum made a Hopkis because he was coming from business, and they held he's not Roy for it, right? If he was in business, he can be good in learning, but since he was in business, so that's a psul. And Rabbi Yosef Leib said, I'm the boss over here, and this is what's going to be. This is it, right? Now, there is such a thing, right, that a person, Godel Shimusha Yosef Milimudai, could be someone else is bigger in learning, but there's more, too, in running a tzibur and running a yeshiva to know how the previous Rosh Yeshiva did it, and that is where Godel Shimusha comes in, and that is one of the reasons why Taka Ben should be the Yairish.
So tell us about, Rabbi Gifter, tell us about your experience in Telz. You were the Rosh Yeshiva there, and then you left.
I was the Rosh Yeshiva there. I'll tell you, B'negeya, the Machlaikis part, okay? I, Baruch Hashem, grew up by my father, world renowned. We don't have to talk about my father. My father wrote, and he gave the paper that he wrote to my uncle, who was a Magid Shir there, Reb Pesach Stein, the famous Mutzlach Dikke Magid Shir in the yeshiva. He wrote him a paper and told him to hold it. That Achar Nisasi, I give over my schusim and tells the yeshiva to my son. Okay. Now, when my father was nifter, I took a very back seat. I didn't do anything. I was called in. You have to do. I said, did I ask you for anything? He says, what, you don't feel an achrayis? I said, I gotta feel I do have an achrayis. But for some reason, right now, it's not negeya. The new kayak that I brought in attracted a lot of buffer. But the people that were there became obsolete. Nobody looked at them, right? They weren't interested in them. So they called the guy in and they told him, you got to leave. You can't come back here. So I told him, everything you're doing is shaloika halacha. You have no right to do that. But I'm not here to fight. But what you're doing is shaloika halacha. The guy left. And then they called me to Din Torah. They brought Reb David Feinstein, Reb Aaron Schechter, and a Rav Yisrael Groomer, who's a Talmud of Reb Shleim Hyman. He's a Rav in the city of Cleveland. And they paskined the Zalman Gifter against Rabbi Chaim Stein. Then, when they lost the Din Torah, they figured out a new Eitzah. You go to court. You're not allowed to go to court. No, we're not going to court about an individual. We're going to court. We're suing the bank in court. Why does the bank of the yeshiva honor the signature of Zalman Gifter? Now, mind you, Zalman Gifter been signing those checks already 15 years. Now, in Telz Yeshiva, Balabatim didn't sign the check. It was the Rosh Yeshiva that signed the check. So they said, who's he? Who's Zalman Gifter? All he is a board member. This is a 501c3. If it's a 501c3, that means there's no owner. Is that correct, Your Honor? So the judge says, of course. There's no such thing as ownership in a non-profit organization. There's a board. So then they said, okay, there's a board. Rabbi Gifter is a member of the board. Are the other members allowed to outvote him? So the judge says, yes. Okay, so that's how they did it. And then they did the shtickers. And then they strangled me. So then I took him to the Satmar Bezdin. And the Satmar Bezdin did all the shtick of making up the entire last 3 years. And they gave a psak that everything that Zalman Gifter says is right. because the Anhola gave him over the yeshiva, his father gave him over the yeshiva, but we're giving that the yeshiva should buy him out for $1 million. So I told him, how in the world do you come to $1 million, number one. Number two, I didn't ask you for aitzes. I came here for a din Torah. It was a din Torah. It was paskened already, and they went to court. That's why I'm coming to you. These people are strangling me because they went to court. I'm not asking for aitzes. Kitzur, this is what they did, and they gave me the $1 million. This in the $1 million is included all back pay and all aitzes of din Torah and court. Now, am I a balabas of Tel's Yeshiva? Yes, I'm a balabas of Tel's Yeshiva because the entire that Satmar Paskin over there was only Benegeya Nihol HaYeshiva, but not on Bailis HaYeshiva. But, you know, the halacha is, the stipler speaks about it in Bava Kama Simin Lamed Ches. Let's say someone is a Miyased HaYeshiva, and then if an oinus happens and he has to go away and someone else takes it over, the other person remains the balabos, right? But that's only because the guy is not there. But if the guy has an oinus and the oinus is not letting him be here, then he doesn't lose his schusim. So I haven't lost my schusim, but right now it's not worth anything.
Pastor Zalman, that's a sad story and my sympathy. And so how would you advise if you were sitting in a Beis Din, right, and you were the Dayan, right, and Hasidim, or it was either a Bistava or the Yeshiva, and they came to you, and they said the old Rosh Yeshiva was Nifta, and he has a son, and the son is a Chacham Ktsas, we don't deny it. But, you know, we want the best. We don't want a Chacham Ktsas, we want somebody who could lead us, etc. How would you paskin?
I would paskin that the Ben of Chacham Ktsas has the title, but for the benefit of the yeshiva, he should bring in a ram which is going to attract an oilam. And you'll get the shlishi, but let him say the shir that's going to attract somebody. It's a win-win situation. That's exactly what I did when I was in Tel's yeshiva.
Which is what I believe they did in Panovich as well, is that correct?
In Panovich, Lezer Kahneman is the Nasi HaYeshiva, and he has Rebbe Lubim Begeshen as Rosh HaYeshiva. And what happened in the Machlokes over there with Reb Shmuel Markovich, I don't know exactly. That's one of the biggest tragedies of Klal Yisrael.
So you're saying basically that you would make it a win-win where, yes, the Bachrim have to be inspired, let's hire a general, but there's still a Nasi to the yeshiva. Look, we founded it, we built it, we collected, and that would remain in the family.
Right.
Yeah. Reb Zalman, it's always an honor to have you with us.
Okay. Batzlacha Rabba.
Both of us. Joining us from Beverly Hills is the rabbi of North Beverly Hills. This is Los Angeles, Rabbi Pinny Donner. He's a scion of the Donner family in England. His father was Rabbi Abba Donner Zecharon Levracha, who was the head of the Conference of European Rabbis, a well-known, you know, advocate for Orthodox Jews in Europe. He's a Talmud of Gateshead, of Baltimore, a musmuch of Lakewood. Welcome, Rabbi Pinny.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto your podcast.
So, Reb Pinny, you are also, you have a degree in Jewish history. You've written books about Jewish history. So, historically, let's talk from both a Chassidish and a Litvish point of view. When did the current sort of the current hanhaga of yeshivas going over, or rabbistavis, rabbonisin going from son to son, oldest son to the oldest son, sometimes not the oldest son. How long has that been in existence? Because clearly when you look at the Rambam, when he brings, you know, the Shalsholos of Torah Shebaal Peh, the 40 Doiros from Moshe all the way to Rav Ashi, there's practically not a son or a son-in-law in there in the entire thing, except for a very brief period by Rav Shem Ben Amiel. But so when did it change and why did it change? That's as a Jewish historian, that's what I ask you.
I wouldn't say it's a brief period. I mean, that's a very important point you just raised. Although there's an anomaly called Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but Rabban Gamliel Hazokain, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, then Rabbi Gamliel of the Sanhedrin, and the various descendants, they trace their way back to David HaMelech. And I think there's your answer, that those who want to project themselves as being part of a royal family or a monarchy find it extremely important to identify themselves with a dynasty. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that Rabban Gamliel was not as great as his father or his grandfather, but clearly it helped him to obtain the position as the Rosh Masifta in Yavne and the head of the Sanhedrin, the fact that his father was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel.
Yeah, but so, out of the 40 generations, this is four or five at the maximum. And is this brief period? And the Marami Panu asked the question in the Sar Mamaris, and he says because it was right after Bayis Sheni, and it was a diminution in Malchus based of it. So he said for a brief period, they since these were all signs of David HaMelech, they wanted to sort of say that the Malchus of David is, you know, is Lame Elamim. So for one brief period, they took the children of David, they merged Kesa Kahuna, Kesa Malchus with Kesa Torah, the Marami Panu says, for a very brief period in time. But absent that, four or five, maximum five times out of the 40, it hadn't happened before or afterwards. Would you agree with that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. However, what I would tell you is this, that part of the revolution, and I would even call it the rebellion of the Hasidic movement, and it is something that was quickly echoed in the non-Hasidic world, was against the system that had emerged that only people who were great Talmidei Chachamim or from their families and people with enormous amounts of wealth controlled the community. And generally speaking, it was wealth, not knowledge of Halacha or Gemara that dominated. And the Hasidic world, and I'm not suggesting to you that there were any of the great Hasidic leaders that we're familiar with who were not either wealthy or knowledgeable in Torah. However, they felt that they wanted to democratize Judaism, and the way to do that was to remove this requirement. Ironically, what happened was is that those people who led the rebellion, and by the way, if you study sociology and politics, you'll discover that this is a very, this is a consistent theme throughout history, that those who lead the rebellion tend to emulate and echo the sins of those that they have rebelled against. And the Hasidic world, which began with this very enigmatic, charismatic leader, the Baal Shem Tov, who we know very little about, quickly evolved into a system of dynastic inheritance where the succession of a Hasidic group, we can talk in a minute about Hasidic groups, was very much determined by who your father was or who your Rebbe was. And that is something which actually became the norm in the Hasidic world to almost the exclusion of any other system of determining where leadership should come from.
So why did that occur?
It depends who you're asking. I know you're asking me, but you know, if you look at scholarship would say that it represents, it would represent a deterioration or an end to the Hasidic revolution. I would say something different. I think that people look for stability, and that a community that has subscribed itself to a particular way of thinking wants to make sure that that way of thinking is going to be preserved and maintained, and particularly if that way of thinking is slightly different or very different from a previous way of thinking, the only way that can be assured is if they align themselves or devote themselves to a family or group that is going to maintain and sustain the standards that they want to uphold. So that's from the ordinary man on the street point of view. as far as the, you know, and I don't want to sound too critical, but as far as the Rebbes themselves were concerned, once they had created the environment which they thought was correct for their followers, you know, for example, let's say you had a Rebbe in a particular place in the Ukraine or Poland, and he'd established a court. If, when he died, that court was going to fall apart, what was going to happen to all his followers? And what's going to happen to his family? So you create a system where a child, obviously one would hope for a worthy child, is going to inherit the mantle of the father or the grandfather. And that being the case, those people who had devoted themselves to a particular way of Jewish life over a period of, one would assume, decades, will continue in that way, and so will their children and grandchildren. So a dynasty ensures continuity, and that's extremely important if you think that your particular way in Judaism is something that is worthy of being sustained. So I'm going to actually use a practical example. In Chabad, the original inheritor of Chabad, so the main Talmud of the Baal HaTanya, was somebody who was called Rabbi Aaron of Strashali.
He believed in Avoda Bespilus, and he wrote Avoda Salevi, I believe.
Yeah, so he was a remarkable individual, and as far as the Baal HaTanya,
an astonishing sefer, by the way, an amazing sefer. It's hard to get, but it's a fabulous sefer.
And I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say it on your podcast, but there's a fantastic book by Dr. Louis Jacobs about him. He was a remarkable individual, and everyone, I'm imagining, within the circle of the Baal HaTanya, imagined that he would inherit the mantle from his father, from his Rebbe. However,
by the way, interestingly, let me interrupt you, Rabbi Dona. Interestingly, the Baal HaTanya, in the Tanya, in the Shulchan Aruch, he writes, not like the Ramah, he says that Keset Torah is not given biyerusha. He says Keset Malchus is biyerusha. He says Keset Kahuna. But he says Keset Torah is not biyerusha, and there is no Yerusha of Sror of Rabbanus. Interesting, right?
It's fascinating. And Baal HaTanya's son, I don't want to go into all the stories. Little Rebbe, who people know very little about. He became the Rebbe, and Reb Aaron was marginalized. In fact, he had a very interesting descendant called Michael Rodkinson, who was the first translator of the Talmud, who eventually ended up in New York and married a Shiksa, and unfortunately is buried in a Gentile cemetery in New York. But he was the first person to translate the Talmud. It's something that your listeners will no doubt be interested to look further into. However, the son of the Baal HaTanya was not an equal to Reb Aaron, and yet he inherited the mantle. And I must assume that within Chabad, the prevailing feeling was at that time that in order to maintain and sustain the message of Chabad, we need to keep a Schneerson. By the way, you know what Schneerson means? It means son of Reb Schneer, and the Baal HaTanya was Reb Schneer Zalman. So we need to keep that family in charge of the organization in order to maintain the identity of this particular branch of the Hasidic movement. So even though Reb Aaron was a much greater person, and even though Reb Aaron was, would have taken the revolution of Hasidus, at least within the Chabad movement, a stage further, they didn't want that revolution to continue. They wanted now to consolidate and make sure that whatever had been achieved until that time would be sustained and maintained through a child of the Rebbe who had died. And that's how the whole Schneerson clan began this movement that we know today as Chabad. There's a lot more to say about Chabad, but that's just one example of why it was that they opted for a dynastic approach as opposed to who is best suited to take the revolution forward.
fascinating. I mean, and you would have to agree, Rabbi Dana, that it's the Hasidim don't have a monopoly on this because, look, in Volozhin, the exact same thing happened. Is that correct?
I'm about to give a lecture on Volozhin on the 25th of February. It's a very sad story because the closure of Volozhin Yeshiva has one cause. Everybody thinks that the reason Volozhin Yeshiva closed was because they insisted on secular studies being incorporated into the curriculum of the yeshiva. It had nothing whatsoever to do with that. On a number of occasions, the Netziv was told by the authorities he would have to close the yeshiva unless he incorporated secular studies. And at some level, he always incorporated those secular studies.
Haskalah killed the yeshiva.
No, the real reason the yeshiva died was because Reb Chaim Berlin was brought in. As you know, he was the rabbi of Moscow. His wife died. He remarried to a very wealthy woman. And he was at a bit of a loss as to what he should do. And his father said, come and take over the Anhole of the yeshiva. I'm getting older. The Bochrim were not interested. And they wanted Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to take over the yeshiva. This is in the late 1880s. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was a grandson, only because he married a granddaughter of the Netziv, and he was not considered as the person who would inherit the yeshiva. Therefore, when his father died, his father was the Rav of Brisk. Originally, he'd been the Rav of Slutsk, but then, by the way, the Beis HaLevi had been a Magid Shir and a Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, but was thrown out by the Netziv. That's why he became the Rav of Slutsk, and later the Rav of Brisk. When he died, his son, Reb Chaim, took over as the Rav of Brisk. He left the Volozhin Yeshiva. The Yeshiva collapsed because nobody liked Reb Chaim Berlin, and the Yeshiva was closed down. So it was all to do with this dynastic approach, and had the Netziv been more circumspect about choosing his successor, had he suggested that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik should be the person who takes over the Yeshiva, perhaps the story would have been different.
So as a historian, can you think, that's a good example, but can you think of other instances and where, you know, better leadership would have had a better result? And again, I'm going to use, because this is, it's hard to find examples. I'm going to skip from culture to culture. But like, you know, when Bill Gates resigned from Microsoft, he was the majority shareholder at one point, right? The largest shareholder, certainly. You know, he didn't take a son or a son-in-law had he had them of age, but he took who we thought was the most competent person in the world, was Steve Ballmer, who created and then after that, he took this Indian gentleman who's, you know, basically tripled the value in the last, 7 or 8 years since he's been there. I doubt if Ballmer's oldest son could have done the job. I mean, do you think in our culture we've had cases where in our, we could have had better leadership, or better leadership would have done a better job both for yeshivas, rabistavas, et cetera? And there's obviously a lot of, conjecture in this question. So I ask it, with using a teaspoon of salt and, understanding that I may be very wrong, or both may be wrong, but I think it's worth asking the question.
I'm going to inject a note of reality into this conversation. Many years ago, my father told me that he heard from his Rebbe. His Rebbe was a man called Reb Shmelka Pinter in London.
I knew Reb Shmelka. I knew his son of Rami Pinter, yeah.
Rami and Reb Chaim. So Reb Shmelka Pinter once told my father, I'm going to use the Galatiana Yiddish in which he said it, 90% of the problems in the world have been seen with Geld. The other 10% have an auch zetin mit Geld. Unfortunately, when you have a family business, you're not going to be so eager to give that business over to somebody who's not a member of your family. So if you've managed to establish a yeshiva or a rabistava, which is the source of income for your family, how pure will your motives be when you think about succession? And I'm sorry to inject that note of reality into this discussion, but one has to imagine that this is not a topic which is immune to bias.
Okay, so can you think of examples? You used Volozhin as an example. Could you think of other examples of where, you know, things fell apart because the wrong leader was chosen?
I can think of examples where, because the leader that was chosen wasn't correct, people just opted for someone else. So, I mean, last year I gave a long talk about the Liska Rebbe of the Bronx, who turned out to be a complete fraud. But the original Liska Rebbe, Reb Herschel, had a Talmud, Reb Shaila Keristira. He also had a son, but nobody was interested in the son, and everybody opted for Reb Shaila Keristira. Now, I'm not suggesting that they made the correct choice, but what I can tell you is that Liska Chassidus literally disappeared without trace, and followers of Reb Shaila of Keristira continue to maintain themselves to this day. I mean, there's no Keristira Chassidus, but he is certainly a much brighter light when it comes to people who want to subscribe to that particular mode of thought than the Liska. So the idea that just because somebody is the son of somebody else, that he is the appropriate leader for a group of people, I'm not sure that it can sustain itself beyond, you know, the immediate group of people who know the original person. You know, the current social experiment perhaps is Chabad, because the Rebbe died in 1994. Chabad has managed to maintain itself for all the years since then. However, you know, if you meet the average Chabad child or grandchild, they don't have that same sense of commitment to the Rebbe as their parents and grandparents, and one wonders what future generations will think of this particular period. So the fact that Chabad opted not to choose the Rebbe after the Rebbe died, it may have made sense at the moment, but in the long haul, was that such a good idea? I mean, I'm just giving you one example. As far as yeshivas are concerned,
but let me just interject. I mean, since the Rebbe's patira, right, there have been Chabad has doubled or tripled or quadrupled in size.
So I don't know what that means.
That means that there have been more Chabad houses that have opened, you know, than while. And you know, many of the Chabad Hasidim that, you know, I meet, I just, it's incredible.
So the one thing I can say about the Rebbe is he was an extremely inspiring figure. I met him twice. He was a man who was extremely inspirational. And what does that mean? That people who met him and people who were devoted to him wanted to make sure that his particular derech in Yahadus would continue and would be, that lots of other people would become Chabad. The fact that there is a Chabad house in Thailand and in Beijing, that's not Chabad Chassidus. That's a branding exercise.
No, I strongly disagree with that. That is such a, I think you're so off point there. The fact that there is a Chabad Chassidus in Thailand, that I'm not a Chabadska, right, is because...
How many Chabad Chassidim are there in Thailand?
Zero. But that's zero. Rabbi Donner, you're totally missing the point, respectfully. The Rebbe was about that every Jew is a neshama. Everybody is a nishmas olikim imal, is a tzelem olikim. Every mitzvah that every Yid does is infinite. And the job of a Chabadski chassid is to make sure that mitzvahs are done by as many Jews, and there's no neshama that misses. Every neshama puts on tefillin. Every mitzvah is a connection with infinity. We touch the Rabbeinu Shleilin with every mitzvah. Doesn't matter if the Jew is in Thailand. Doesn't matter if he's in Shoyal Tachtis. Right? That is the message of Chabad. Has nothing to do, and Chabad is different than every other chassidus in respect, that his goal was not to, it's not Chabad. It's we look way beyond Chabad. We look for every neshama of every yid, and I would suggest even possibly if he believed in being that goyim should be niskarv to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. So he was not about doing for zich. It wasn't about a family exercise. The Chabadskas, for the most part, live in poverty, the shluchim. They live with incredible mesiris nefesh, and they don't ask for nothing in return. Please put on tefillin. I'll tell you something. I have a daughter. She works for Aleph, right, whose job is to advocate for Jewish prisoners. You talk about not getting any comfort for you.
I work very closely with Aleph.
Okay, and she says that her Chabad, the guy who's in charge of her, she gets emails from him at 2 in the morning and at 3 in the morning and at 5 in the morning and at 6 in the morning. Could you please write a letter for prisoner number 126 who's in jail in Colorado, somebody he never met? You're not going to get shlishi for it, because the Rebbe said that every Jew is a chelik alei kamimal, and they'll do it in Thailand, and they do it in prison, and they ask for nothing.
I'm not suggesting you're wrong. I'm just saying that. Okay, I mean, that's an interesting question. Is it about principle? Is it about ideals? Or is it about numbers? Is it about, ultimately, any Jew living in Golus has to think to himself, what is our purpose? What are we here for? What are we doing? And everybody comes to their own conclusion. So, as far as Satmar is concerned, just to use one extreme example, you have to make sure that those people who welcome Mashiach haven't compromised on any of the values of Judaism at any point during the Golus, because otherwise they're not worthy of greeting Moshiach. As far as Chabad is concerned, we have to make sure that the widest possible range of people are going to be ready to greet the Moshiach, and that those people, whether they keep all the mitzvahs or only one mitzvah, are going to be open to the concept of Moshiach coming. So, I'm just using two extremes of a particular idea. The fact that that Chabad evolved from making people or creating people who are committed to Judaism into an organization that just wants to assist people in performing a particular mitzvah, whether it's putting on tefillin or keeping Shabbos when they happen to be in whatever place they are in, that is an interesting development, because that's not what the Chassidus of Chabad was about. It happens to be what the Rebbe thought was a good idea, and I'm not saying it's a bad idea. It changed the tone of what that Chassidus was about. And if you subscribe to it, you don't subscribe to it. What's interesting is that beyond the Rebbe, there was no further development. You're talking about dynastic succession. The fact is, the Rebbe died in 1994, and since that time, there's no Rebbe. So we are completely reliant on the fact that the Rebbe presented the ideology in the way that he did, and now we have to subscribe to that ideology. It's not an evolving ideology. It becomes the ideology that is frozen in time, and now that's the way we have to do it. Is it the perfect way to do it? I've got no idea. It's the type of thing you say, ask me in 100 years.
Okay, but let's go back to our point. Can you think of your case with Reb Chaim Berlin was a perfect case in point of cases where, the failure of the ability, choosing the wrong leader because he was, kol ha-kaidim l'nachla, right, kaidim l'yerusha, is created, a disastrous event. Just like we're going to have on a corporate expert who's going to give us example of corporations who chose family members. Can you think of any other examples besides Reb Chaim Berlin and your case in Lisk, which honestly is sort of a minor thing? I don't really associate, but something else we could associate with?
I think that, many of the yeshivas that we are familiar with who've chosen Rosh Hashivas because they happen to be the son of the previous Rosh Hashiva have suffered as a result because they haven't chosen the best person. That means in any corporation, when you are, you know, let's say a CEO comes in and says, I'd like to retire. I'm 64 years old. In a year's time, I'm going to be 65. I want to retire. What will the corporation do? Are they going to ask his son to become the CEO? Or are they going to, you know, do a search for the best CEO? So if there's a yeshiva, a great yeshiva, there's 1,000 bachurim in the yeshiva, and whoever the CEO is now reached the age where he's no longer at his, you know, he's no longer at the height of his power in terms of being able to attract bachurim and give the best shir, whatever it is that you, whatever attached to what it requires to being a Rosh Hashiva. Now, how are we going to choose the new Rosh Hashiva? So if the board of the yeshiva, whoever controls the yeshiva, is going to say, well, we can't have this discussion because obviously the next Rosh Hashiva is going to be the son of the previous Rosh Hashiva, then essentially what you're saying is that you're leaving things to chance, because the son of the previous Rosh Hashiva, just because he happens to be a son, may not be the best person to take the yeshiva forward into the next era, into the next generation, and whatever it is that you need to do. So the problem is that, you know, many yeshivas and many chassidus, you know, rabbistavus, operate on the basis that because somebody is somebody else's son, that they are the natural heir to run the organization or institution or group which their father led. But that's not necessarily the case. By the way, sometimes it could be the case.
So let me ask you a question, Rabbi Donal. Let me ask you a question. Let's go back to the case of the Netziv. The Netziv was an Adam Gadol Moed, right? His whole life was a Lajan.
Unbelievable. He was a stump Adam Gadol. 40 years he led the yeshiva.
Right, so my question to you is, why did he make this decision? I mean, and to say that he was worried about how his son is going to do financially, I don't know, I don't really believe that.
His son had plenty of money. That's what's so weird.
So why do you think he did it?
He was sentimental, he was old, he was weak.
You know what, and I'll give you a different possibility. And the possibility is, he said, you know, running a yeshiva takes tremendous, it's not like a corporation where you get paid for it, right? It's, for the most part, chinuch is, you know, a somewhat thankless job. And his attitude was, maybe Reb Chaim is the biggest, or whoever it was, is the biggest Rosh Hashiva in the world. Is he going to want to go collect at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night in snowstorms? Is he going to want to fight with the communists, the Bundes, whoever, some of the bad Bachram, and if you read history, the Lashon had some really bad Bachram. Is he going to want to go fight with the government who tried to close him down 100 times? I mean, a lot more factors go into it than who is the biggest lamdan, right? So I would put to you that he said a family member, who this is their blood, will die for the yeshiva. It's the family business. And is there any truth to that thought? Like, it's very different than a corporation in respect that it's often a thankless job. I mean, my father-in-law was a Rosh Hashiva. He lived in poverty, right? He worked really hard. Collecting is embarrassing. It's you put up with abuse. You put up with bizyonis. You know, a lot of people don't want that job. So he says, the family, you're brought up in this. You have a chinuch in this. And this is why he chose Reb Chaim Berlin. Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. I'm not denying it. It is a possibility. However, I think that, you know, if it's an unbiased, uninfluenced opinion, then that's wonderful. In other words, if you pass that opinion through other people, you know, they're third parties who agree with you, and not because they feel they need to agree with you, that the choice that you've made is best for the future of the institution that you're running, then that's fine. I'm always struck by the picture whenever you go into a Marriott hotel of the original person who founded Marriott Hotels together with his son. And by the way, they look identical.
Yes, I know them both. I knew that one of them, yeah.
So, that, you know, there they are. The son ran Marriott and he did a very good job. So, I get that, you know, a child of a particular person who founded a business may be the best person placed to ensure the future of that business. However, it's not always the case. You know, I'm sure that if you go into Hilton, you won't find that picture because the children of the original Hilton were not appropriate to take over that business. So,
right.
You know, not necessarily true. And if you make that the rule, then what you're basically doing is you are confining yourself to people from within the family to run the family business, and they may not be the appropriate person to do that. Now, it may be very tough to tell them that because everybody wants to be able to inherit a business from their father, grandfather, and not have to worry about their parnassa. But just because, you know, that's the particular, but the universal issue is this the best thing for the future of the institution? And it's not necessarily true that the child of the person who founded the institution or of the family who founded the institution are the best person to take it forward. Maybe there are better people who are going to have broader minds and broader shoulders and, you know, better ideas as to how that institution should be taken forward. And those should be the people who take it forward. That doesn't mean that they're going to exclude the original family, but what it means is you're going to be able to maintain whatever it is that this institution originated and take it forward into the next generation.
Rabbi Zunna, this was fascinating, and we must have you on again. We discuss very often topics that have historical relevance. It was great having you. We look forward to having you again.
Thank you so much, Abdovid. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Joining us from Alexandria, Virginia, is Jack Marshall. Jack is the president of an international consulting firm whose specialty is ethics and hiring, succession. He is a consultant with Fortune 500 companies in their succession planning. Welcome, Jack.
Welcome. Thank you, and very, very much enjoy the opportunity.
So, Jack, here's the question. I read online, I mean, I used Google, that third generation, 4% of family businesses survive into the third generation. The number is different variations of that number. And clearly because there's some type of misfiring in the way succession is planned. So my question to you is, and this is going to be if I was an attorney, and I know you're an attorney, by the way, Harvard graduate, Georgetown graduate, Jack is, I would be probably reprimanded by the judge, but I'm going to ask you a leading question. Why is it that Microsoft founder Bill Gates retired? Why didn't he take one of his children to be the next president? Apple, Steve Jobs, he had a whole flock of kids. Why didn't his family take over for the next president? And, you know, Google, he retired, the two founders. Why didn't their son? And why did they do a worldwide search? And the logic being, look for a family member. They're more committed. They know the culture. It's in their blood. I mean, it's through the sweat and tears of their ancestors that this was built. They would be more dedicated. Why did they go outside their firms?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that the considerations with a smaller business and the, as you mentioned, there's always good ethical reasons to want to pass on a business. A parent has developed a livelihood, assets, a business, a reputation, and it is completely consistent with parental ethics and those duties to want to pass along the fruits of the parents' labor onto the children. When this involves, though, a large corporation, and there are lots of other stakeholders and stockholders and many employees and everything else, then a consideration has to be made about whether it is also a responsible handoff. So that if you've happen to have an individual who is a son or a daughter who has skills in that area and an interest in going forward, and the founder can say in good conscience, I can both meet my parental obligations and duties to my offspring and to my stockholders and to all the stakeholders and customers, because not only will this preserve the traditions and culture that has linked my family to this company, but it will also ensure that I will have competent management going forward. And I don't know anything about Bill Gates' kids, but I do know that a continuing problem has, you know, my own son has absolutely no interest in anything I do. His interests are completely in other areas. And that situation turns up a lot, and also you have situations where the individual who inherits a business is either ill-suited temperamentally or from a matter of diligence or dedication. This is one thing you see a lot in the restaurant industry.
Question, Jack. Let me of the 500 Fortune 500 companies, can you think of any that was taken over by an immediate son or daughter?
Well, Ford was the obvious example. I mean, Ford was really had a dynasty where Henry Ford Jr. and a succession of Fords basically ran that company and did it rather well. I mean, they're sort of the perfect example of the other approach, where you actually do treat even a large multinational company as something that can be handed down from family member to family member. Major League Baseball teams when they started out, like the Washington Senators, were originally run by a series of leaders in the Griffith family until the team was sold, and they thrived for a while from a business standpoint.
But is it interesting that of all Fortune 500 companies, there's really like one or two that you could think of that actually were successful by handing it down to their kids?
Yeah, I mean, I it is interesting, and
And even, by the way, if you look at Ford, just for the record, Ford in the year 2000 traded at around $40, right?
Yep.
And today, Ford is trading at $8.
Yep.
So over a 20-year period, it's lost more than 75% of its value, something like 75% of its value. So it really hasn't been doing actually all that well. So is it fair to say then that the reason why Microsoft hired its new CEO, or Apple hired this fellow Cook, is because it's highly unlikely? I mean, they searched the world to find this one person, and it's fairly remote that, you know, the child of this particular one should be the one that of all the people in the world is the most qualified, and they have the resources to hire the most qualified person. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yes, and it's not just, of course, son. Sometimes we see the close relative of nepotism, with where it's kept in the family, has similar unfortunate consequences. For example, you know, Walt Disney's successor after he died was his brother, and the company basically crashed until they went and found another CEO who had not certainly Walt Disney's brilliance, but special talents in marketing and development. So I think as a general proposition, it is highly unlikely that a member of a family is going to be the best person to take over, except, you know, there are always exceptions in very, very rarefied businesses and situations where a son or a daughter or a brother or sometimes we see it with a spouse has unusual insight into how the company ran as a result of being intimately involved. But what you say is exactly right. Most of the time, it's a bad gamble, and most of the time, it's seen as a bad gamble. So when a CEO hands it over to a son or a daughter, stockholders and others within the organization are likely to become suspicious, doubtful, lose their trust, and that alone, even if the individual who is sort of inheriting the job is competent, the suspicion and lack of trust that this engenders is itself destructive.
Now, what about in the university setting? Is nepotism a healthy or unhealthy thing in succession for universities? Like, you went to Harvard. Would it be befitting of Harvard, let's say, for the, you know, the last president, Larry Summers' son, would take over? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I don't know that that's ever been done, but it would be certainly a terrible idea that academia and the faculty would be very suspicious of. I don't know that that's ever happened except in some. I'm trying to think. Oral Roberts University is the only one I can.
And why not? Why not? Why wouldn't you take Larry Summerson? He knows the culture. He knows the school. He knows the professors, which are good, which are bad. Like, it would seem to be such a fitting thing to do.
Well, except Larry Summers had to resign himself, so they might not be
able okay. to. Well, choose another one, a more successful.
President Conant, if you had President Conant's son, and he was certainly
right.
one of the finest presidents Harvard ever had. And you know, in the right circumstance, I could see that developing. But again, you know, as we've seen with the sons of presidents and others, while there is a bias often in favor of the offspring, we also know from experience that talent, brilliance, and expertise is not that often passed on, and we've seen that through the British.
Give us some examples. Give us a few examples of where nepotism has harmed either in academia or in the corporate world.
I can't think of one in academia. Can you? I don't recall ever seeing the nepotism in academia being a particularly
ever happening. Talk about in the corporate world. Where have you seen where somebody tried to hand to a son and it had a negative output?
Well, we see it frequently. You know, as I was starting to say, in businesses like the restaurant business that take unusual dedication, and some of the most successful restaurants, and they become big business, and they become, you know, cultural institutions. Pass along. I remember in Boston, an iconic restaurant was Jimmy's Harborside, which I used to go to with my parents for every birthday, and it was a landmark. But when Jimmy was there, you know, 24 hours a day, running a restaurant is total immersion. He passed it on to his son, and his son sold it and got the heck out of the business, and that was the end of it, because it's a different thing. And of course, psychologically, there's a problem with a son. And Henry Ford too actually talked about this and wrote about this. He was not seen as the equal of his father in a lot of ways. He was in his shadow in many many respects. And so it's a personal sacrifice sometimes for a son or a daughter to just step into. Into the shoes of the founder. This is, as you may recall, Hugh Hefner passed on the management of the Playboy Corporation to his daughter, and the company really proceeded to sink and sink fast under her leadership for a lot of reasons. I mean, she it may have had personality, it may have been image, but the fact is, She was not able to keep that, make the changes and adjust as Hefner himself had been able to do. So sometime, I think it was in his late 70s, he passed along that to his daughter, and his daughter pretty much allowed the company to run into the ground.
So in closing, if you want to pass on a family business, a substantial sized family business, and you wanted to tell, you know, the next generation, look, you know, if you want this to be successful, here are, you know, this is what you should be looking for in a successor. What would that look like?
Well, I think what you have to do is lay out the entire group of characteristics you want for leadership, which means individuals who have independence, that they understand management and have management experience, that they have been able to rise to a position where they're qualified for management without getting unfair advantages or being yanked up the ladder by forces that have nothing to do with their own ability. And you want to find someone who people who have proven abilities that are not linked to genetic connections or names. Now, if that happens to be someone who is related to someone passing on a company, that's great, and sometimes that may in fact be a prudent thing to do. But the point is, with all nepotism, is it creates the appearance of impropriety. It undermines trust. It makes the entire organization vulnerable to distrust, suspicion, and a lack of optimism in the future. So if you're going to do that, you had better have really, really good reasons. Otherwise, nepotism is something that the default position should be to avoid it.
Well, thank you very much, Jack. That was most informative.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Hope to talk to you again.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joining us from Chicago is Drew Mendoza, who is the senior advisor of the Family Business Consulting Group. Right, he specializes in assessing the needs of corporate held, closely held businesses. He's helped thousands of businesses since their founding in 1994. He's an author. He's a Harvard graduate. He's received prestigious awards, the Richard Packard Practice Award by the Family Firm Institute for his outstanding introduction to the family, to the field of family business. He's an FFI fellow. Welcome, Drew.
Thank you, Dave.
So,
thank you, Dave.
Question. As an expert in the field of family businesses, let's say somebody has a family business. Well, what percentage of family businesses that go from, you know, father to child, or could be son, daughter, son-in-law, et cetera, make it to the third or fourth generation? And what percentage just fall apart because at a certain point, you know, not having selected the appropriate leadership meets market demands, and it's a brutal market. It's certainly survival of the fittest in the business world, and therefore don't. Could you have statistics on that?
The early research on this, which has been replicated globally, finds that roughly one-third of family firms, defined as, you know, owned by the family, but for us, that it's intended to continue under family ownership, will transition from one generation to the next. So, you know, in that spirit, if we went back 100 years and we put 100 family businesses into a room and came back 100 years later, there would be four or so still standing and active. That said, there's two...
4%. That would be 4%. You mean after it's 33 for the next generation times 33 times 0.33 times 0.33. So 33 turns into 4, okay?
Yeah, okay. So... However, okay, that's just a number. We need to understand what's behind that number. And that includes, if it were a publicly traded company, if we put, you know, the top 100 publicly traded companies from 100 years ago into a room and came back a century later, only GE would still be on the list. All the others would be gone. So, you know, on the one hand, one might say that family businesses outlast non-family businesses by a power of four. The other facet of this to recognize is that, you know, sometimes a business is best sold, or shutter its doors because the product or service that they are providing has gone the way of the Naga. There's no longer a market for it, and they didn't keep up with innovation and change.
But you're saying then that family businesses have a better survival rate than public companies?
Yes.
Why don't we do the same here? Say, look, let's put aside our litigious culture. This guy owned the majority. We know that having the oldest kid in the business seems to be working. Why didn't Steve Jobs put his oldest kid in, or Bill Gates put his oldest kid in?
Because in our culture, in our country, these other family members have a voice.
But
in Japan,
but
you don't get a voice.
But if it's best for the company, tell them, look, there's a history that this is best for the company, and let's do it that way. It's for your benefit. Don't you want to be around in 100 years from now?
It does not work that way in any other country but Japan. And I understand your point. I understand what you're saying. Why not? And
we want longevity.
Quite frankly, it's because, you know, at least in our country, in North America and throughout Europe, they're finding that, you know, business is changing quickly and you need to have the very best leaders. I don't know how much longer that, you know, the statistics of what's happened in Japan are going to be able to remain sustainable.
So let me ask you the question. What would the Fortune 500 companies look like if instead of doing a worldwide search, both internally, you do start internally and externally for the best possible leaders, they went the primogeniture route and they took the oldest child of each one of the founders of these many tech companies. You know, Facebook would go to his daughter. Ellison's company, he brought in, you know, some of the best guys. He brought in the guy from HP. Instead, he brought in his son, David. What would the result be if they went the family route as opposed to the nepotism route, as opposed to searching for the top leaders in the world?
My sense is that it would not work as well. And increasingly, we see family businesses saying to their offspring, look, if you'd like to work here, if you'd like to be a leader here, this is the path you have to follow, and these are the hoops you're going to need to jump through. And the decision for leadership is not made by the founder, but rather it's made in the boardroom, ideally by independent outside directors.
And family businesses, can you think of stories where they brought in somebody who was hyper-qualified and stories where they said, we're going with the oldest kid and what the outcomes were? Like, do any come to mind? Or in public companies, can you think of any large public companies that bucked the trend and actually brought in the oldest kid as their head?
There are examples. Let's go with the first one, right? Where I think you were suggesting, you know, they searched, they brought in an outside leader, and that leader fell flat and was ultimately replaced by a family member. That will happen when the the bridge manager or the outside executive that's brought in does not appreciate the power of family and doesn't recognize that there are unstated rules in most families and that the values of that family have got to be adhered to. And, you know, if they come in and just run it as a business looking for short-term gains and quarterly returns, yeah, as likely as not, they're not going to succeed in the long term. They'll be asked to leave. And in return, they often will then replace that person with a family member who kind of gets it, who understands the culture and what business they're really in. So
do you encourage families, larger family corporations that are looking to pass it on and keep the business open for the next generation, do you encourage them to hire a child to run it, or do you encourage them to do a search for who is the most competent person in the country, worldwide, etc.?
We encourage them to pull the shareholders together to have an aligned shareholder group with regards to expectations of things like growth and risk and profitability and liquidity, leadership, culture, et cetera, And from that, we expect management and the board to develop a strategic plan and vision, and that will then drive the selection process. And yes, we typically will recommend that outsiders be considered as well. As well as, you know, family members.
Well, Drew, thank you very much for your time and your wise advice.
Well, I don't know how wise it is, but thank you.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.